My wife and I like to watch TV, as I'm sure many of you do. The problem is we are frugal, not cheap, frugal. So we don't have cable or satellite, so we watch what you can get for free online a lot. So we do use services such as Hulu. The problem with Hulu, though, are you familiar with Hulu? Several of you, it's an online streaming service that shows TV shows. The problem with Hulu is they don't show shows live. They show them afterwards. And I'm sure many of you, if you don't know Hulu, you've used DVR, you know, something like that. You've maybe got DVDs of a show or something. But we like Facebook too, social media. And on certain shows that Tracy watches, she has had things revealed to her while people are watching it live and commenting about the show on Facebook. And she's like, "I didn't know that character was going to die. Why'd they tell me that?" And she doesn't get that active, but it's a bit of a caricature. But she gets upset, you know, and I'll get upset too if some spoiler is ruined because some jerk posted something on Facebook and we're cheap, and so we haven't gotten to watch the show yet. And so sometimes there'll be spoilers. That's similar to how God knows the spoilers for all of time. To him, it's like they're shows that he's already watched. And he reveals some of those spoilers to Daniel. Daniel actually does get upset that these spoilers are revealed to him, but for different reasons than we get upset. We'll see that as we get into today. But before I can get into today's prophecy, I should give you all a history lesson. A few weeks ago, before Daniel, we talked about Daniel chapter 5. Everyone really enjoyed the history lesson I gave, and I say everyone as in like the five people who told me they really liked it afterwards. But everyone really liked the history lesson, and so I'm going to start with a history lesson this week. If you don't like history, you're doomed to repeat it, so ha. And today's history lesson revolves around someone you've probably heard of before. His name is Alexander the Great. And most of us have heard of Alexander the Great before. He really did kind of earn the title the Great. He did something many or very few people did. At the age of 20, he became king, but then he was just Alexander III of Macedon. In 256 is when he was born, but at the age of 20, he becomes king. Within 12 years, he's conquered the world. Not many people can say they've done that. Just many people have tried to conquer the world, but he actually succeeds in conquering the world. Of the nations he conquered, one of them was the Medo-Persian Empire. And that empire is important to know. You might have heard me reference it a couple times already in our discussion of the book of Daniel. It comes up a few times. The Medo-Persian Empire was made up of two individual empires that sort of rallied their strength together. The Persians were stronger, and as they were going through conquering people, the Medes, instead of getting just wiped out, they joined forces. And so now they're this like superpower that goes across the earth. Nobody can stop them. At one point, and this is not just known world, at one point across the entire world, it's estimated they controlled 44% of the world's population. That's a lot of people for one empire to be in charge of. And that's not just, you know, like the Western section of the world that you usually see in like known world, but that's the whole thing. 44%, it's quite a bit. But then this punk kid Alexander shows up on the scene, and he beats up the unstoppable force of the Medo-Persian army. In fact, he kind of levels them. That's the Battle of Issus in 333 BC, and he takes over the people who were able to fall Babylon. He's able to conquer them. But then at the age of 32, guess what happens? Alexander dies. He set out to conquer the world. He conquers the world, moves to Babylon, where he's going to set up his capital city. He's going to live there, and then he dies. At the peak of his power, he's about ready to, like, "I've just conquered everything, and let me rule it." That's when he dies. All of his years spent fighting. Now, the largest domain to ever be ruled by one single person has no clear ruler. He had two children, but they were murdered very shortly after his death. And so now no one really knows who's going to rule the largest empire to ever exist. And so fighting breaks out amongst his generals. He has four main generals, and his nation ends up being broken into four parts, each controlled by a different general. Eventually, the empire is in those four pieces. But eventually, two of those four generals come to control lands that are important to discussion of biblical history. And those two rulers are Seleucus, who ruled northern Syria, Mesopotamia, which includes Babylon, and a few other regions to the east. And then Ptolemy is the other guy, and he ruled southern Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. Now, you know the section Palestine. We hear that in the news a lot. That's Jerusalem. That's Israel. That's Judah, that area right there. And if you know Mesopotamia is like right next to it. And so one general rules this section, the other general rules this section. Here's the people of God smack dab right in the middle. And they have lots of fighting. They get war-torn for a while, and this all goes on for a little bit. Then eventually, whoever owns that land is settled, but by then a couple generals have died. We now get this general named Antiochus, and he's a horrible, horrible person. You might have heard of Antiochus before. Later, rabbis wrote about him, and they just called him the wicked. They just stopped calling him by his name. It's almost like you say, the one whom we do not name. It's almost like that. He's the wicked guy. Don't even give him a name. He's just wicked. And he really was wicked. He ruled from 223 to 187 BC. During that time, Jerusalem was his, and he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, have you heard the word epiphany before? You know what an epiphany is. It's a manifestation. It's, oh, aha, it's getting... But originally, the word meant a manifestation of God. So now it's like, oh, I just had God speak to me is the idea behind that. Back then it was, oh, God's present is the word epiphanies. And so he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. It might be like someone who grows up, takes over a nation, then says, you know what, call me Emmanuel. No, it might be like that. Or someone who changes their name to Jesus. It's similar to that. He was Antiochus Epiphanes is what he was told to be called. On his coins, the coins of the nation said, King Antiochus, God manifest, was what he wrote. So he's calling himself God. He thinks he's like God. A lot of people actually took to calling him Antiochus Epimenes, though, because Epimenes means the mad one. And so they would often switch a couple letters there. But the prime directive of the Greek Empire, even after it was broken up into four chunks, was Hellenization. Have you heard of the word Hellenization before? It's everybody becomes Greek. That's the idea of Hellenization, the spread of Greek culture. Not like a melting pot of everybody mix in, but no, everyone starts sharing in Greek culture, become like a Greek culture person. Antiochus was so devoted to those standing orders of the Greek Empire that it became his goal to do that almost to the exclusion of his humanity. He was a major jerk about how he went about doing it. He outlawed and removed the Ten Commandments from the Israelites. He said no one is allowed to quote them or to ever read them. And it makes sense, though, because he called himself God, and the first commandment is what? Have no other gods. And so it kind of makes sense he wouldn't like those. He also outlawed practice of the Sabbath. He also mass murdered babies who were circumcised. He was not a good person by any means. As you can tell, he targeted the Jewish faith. In 176 BC, he defiled the Jerusalem temple even. He took it a step further. You know, you guys won't give up your temple. Try to do it peacefully. Now I'm just going to come in and take over the temple. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which take place after the book of Daniel, where we're at now, Ezra and Nehemiah is when they rebuilt the temple and the city wall. But he doesn't tear it down again. He just invades it and sets up a shrine inside of it. He puts an altar to the god of Zeus inside of the Jerusalem temple and slaughters pigs there. If you know kosher laws, you know pigs are kind of a big deal to the Jewish people. And he slaughters pigs on purpose. Not just that's what he happened to have. He got the most offensive animal he could find to sacrifice in the temple, and he sacrifices that there. He also outlaws the burning of burnt offerings. Burnt offerings are how you stayed in communication with God, how you stayed in communion with God. To us, it would be like a ruler outlawing the Lord's Supper. We wouldn't like that very much, but it'd be very obvious he's attacking their faith. Antiochus did all these things, and as you can imagine, the Jews do not like it, and so they rebel. That rebellion is called the Maccabean Rebellion. You might have heard of the Maccabees before. The Maccabees are there's four books of the Maccabees, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees. It's found in a collection of writings that some Bibles you'll find between the Old and the New Testaments. It is sometimes called the Apocrypha. It's the books that a lot of people, even the ones who include in their Bibles, most people do not necessarily say that it's God-breathed and the equivalent with Scripture, but it's good historical books for the people of God. That's the idea behind these books. We don't include them in our Bibles because we don't believe that they're God-breathed. They're not terrible books, though. It's just, if you're going to pick one, I'd rather you read actual Scripture. But it's not a bad thing to read them, including this history of the Maccabean people. These people who were trying to do what they thought God was telling them to do. And I bet if you haven't heard of the Maccabees, you have heard of their holiday, Hanukkah. So you've heard of that before. If you haven't heard of the Maccabees or Seleucids or all these other names I've been throwing out, you've heard the word Hanukkah. It's the celebration of the initiation, or the initiation of Hanukkah was the Maccabean revolt during that process. It's celebrating that rebellion there. And so that's the history lesson from Alexander the Great to Hanukkah. That's the history lesson I want to cover for today, if that makes sense. And you might be asking, why are you telling me about Hanukkah and Alexander the Great? I had some phlegm, and that just sounded like I said it the right way on accident. But today, Daniel tells us about one of his visions, And it actually makes a whole lot of sense if you know the history lesson I just told you. The vision is not that confusing if you know the history that I just went over. It was confusing for Daniel because to him it was like spoilers for a TV show that he had never heard of yet. It'd be like revealing the parts of a TV show and be like, ah, here's the spoilers. And Daniel's like, what is Grey's Anatomy? I have no idea what that is. It's similar to that sort of thing there. It's several hundred years in the future for Daniel, but it's 2,000 years in the past for us. So it, even though it's in future tense, to Daniel was still the future, a lot of these things. So let's read this prophecy, see what we can get out of it, see if that makes sense, what I just said at least. Daniel chapter 8, verses 1 through 4 is what I will read first. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me. Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. So he's referring to last chapter's vision. He's saying, here's the one that came later. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. We read that Daniel saw this vision during the third year of Belshazzar. Babylon was still ruled by the Chaldean Babylonian dynasty, so Medo-Persians weren't on the scene yet. The Medo-Persian Empire actually rose up really quickly, and so people in Babylon didn't really care about them much. But Daniel's prophesying about them. What he describes is this animal with funky horns, which, if you remember from earlier prophecies, animals quite often represent dynasties or kings or nations. And so here's this animal. It's got two horns, so it's got two means of power and weaponry, and one is stronger than the other. One started earlier than the other, and that sounds very similar, actually, to the Medo-Persian dynasties combining. And it makes more sense as we move on to... We see them also, there's this animal with these two powers, and it's running around doing whatever it feels like. No one can stop it. They seem super strong. But then you get to the next verse when this punk kid gets on the scene. So let's read this next part, verses 5 through 8. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came up from the west across the face of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him, and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. So nothing could hold down this other animal. He's prancing around doing whatever he feels like, and then comes this quick animal going faster, so fast he's not even touching the ground as he runs. He just wipes out everything in his path, stops this goat, or the ram that nobody thought could be beaten, and now he's in charge. But then at the peak of his power, this horn is broken off, and then four horns rise up in its place. That sounds a bit like Alexander the Great's method. I mean, it's used in animal imagery, but that matches pretty well with what happened with Alexander the Great's history. And so let's keep reading, verses 9 through 11. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown, and a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Now Antiochus grew out of one of the four generals. He was one of the guys who grew up out of one of these four horns, if we're agreeing that my interpretation here is making sense. He appeared to rival God himself, at least he's considering it so, and he takes over God's temple. And in olden days, remember, if you conquer another nation's temple, another god's temple, in antiquity speak, it means you're stronger than that god. And he trampled on the priesthood. He threw to the ground what could be considered stars of the Jewish people. He threw them down. He very literally threw truth to the ground as he collected copies of the Torah to be thrown into piles and burned. Just as Daniel's vision talks about, too, he overthrew the temple of God's people. He stops the sacrifices and burnt offerings, just like it says in this prophecy, and for a time he prospers. And the exact time it's given that he prospers is given in the next verse, the next two verses, 13 and 14. Then I heard a holy one speaking, And another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, and the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Now, 2,300 evenings and mornings is what it says. 2,300 evenings plus mornings, I think. There's some disagreement here. But it's not 2,300 days. It's half of that is the amount of days you've got. And that's roughly 3.5 years with a lunar calendar, so the months are a different length. But that's roughly 3.5 years, which just so happens is the approximate time it took from when Antiochus took over the temple to the Maccabean revolt succeeding and taking back the temple. It was just about 3.5 years. Give or take a little bit. Without knowledge of that history, the prophecy is kind of goofy, right? It's about this ram, and this goat tramples him, and the goat's horn breaks off, and four horns appear, and this little horn gets crazy big and fights people in heaven, and all this bad stuff, and the burnt offerings go away. That's what we see if you don't know the history, but the history makes it not crazy, right? I mean, it parallels what happened in history pretty well. In case you want to argue that I'm just selectively stating my history, or in case you want to argue, or maybe you want to say, "Adam, you're really good at interpreting prophecy," and maybe you want to say that, but just skip down a few verses, and you can't argue with me that I'm interpreting it wrong at this point, because let's read verses 20 and following. "As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia." So, I mean, he actually starts to explain here, so I'm not, like, making stuff up. "These are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that is broken, in place of which four others rose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise." So see, I wasn't just making stuff up. I wasn't just creatively telling history in order to get it to fit into the prophecy. The Bible doesn't just say, "Hey, these are kings." It says which kings it's actually talking about. It says, "Hey, here's these kings. These are the ones I'm talking about," in case you don't get it. A lot easier than last chapter. Last chapter, it's like, "Oh yeah, there's four kings." This chapter, it's, "This is this king. This is this king." And so it's a bit easier to interpret in this chapter. It's an extremely accurate prophecy, too. So accurate, in fact, that several scholars have refused to say that Daniel actually wrote in the third year of Belshazzar, because they think there's no way that he could have prophesied that accurately, because prophecy doesn't really happen in their opinions. And so this had to have been written about the second century, midway through, which is when these things had finished happening. That's when they argue, there's no way he could have prophesied, no one could have guessed that well, Daniel couldn't have written it then, it must have been way later. That's too accurate for their tastes. My view of biblical inspiration, however, is that the text is never going to be deceptive. And so when it says that he wrote this stuff in the third year of King Belshazzar, I'm going to go ahead and trust Daniel there. But it's not just blind faith, though. It's not just me saying I'm not going to refuse to change my hermeneutic. It's actually, there's some other proof behind it, too. So, it can be backed up by other factors. But those factors take us beyond today's scope. The last verse of this prophecy, Daniel chapter 8, verse 27, is, "And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it." So Daniel gets sick for a few days after seeing this vision. It was so terrorizing to him, he couldn't get up for a while. If you have a weak stomach or you like wholesome things, don't look up the stuff that Antiochus' so-called Epiphanes did. They are not pretty things and not good images, and I do not blame Daniel for seeing this vision getting sick. I mean, I don't blame him. I probably would get sick, too. It's pretty horrible, terrible stuff. He earned the name of the wicked. And so we've got this prophecy. Daniel didn't understand it because it was 400 years beyond him when this prophecy would have ended. It's 2,000 years for the past for us, though. Is that the end of our discussion in Daniel chapter 8? Is it like, okay, we've got this, it's in the bag, easy prophecy. All right, let's move on to Daniel chapter 9. Is that like the end of our discussion here? Not quite, or else I wouldn't be asking that question, right? Maybe you're like, please, do stop here. But we can't stop there because there are a couple verses in the middle that I skipped. You like how I creatively did that and no one really noticed? So you have to be careful readers, too, when you're listening to any preacher, not just myself. I'll never try to steer you wrong, but I could. I'll never do it on purpose, at least. But verses 15, 16, and 17 are the ones I skipped. And in there's this phrase that sticks out. And so I'm gonna read these verses for you. "When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face, but he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. And then the very next verse is when he says, and in case you're curious, these two kings are Medo-Persia, this next king is the king of Greece, and he goes on. But what's up with the comment of this is for the time of the end? Because the very next verse, then he starts talking about something that's only 400 years in the future and 2,000 years in the past for us. But he says this is for the time of the end. And so that gets the people caught up a little bit. Because honestly, this prophecy's interpretation is very cut and dry. The Bible isn't, it's not confusing here. I mean, it's written in apocalyptic imagery, but if you know the history, you can be like, yeah, that's the history. That's what this prophecy was about. We got it. This is what it means. But then there's this, the end comment here. What does Gabriel, whose name means God's hero, mean by that comment? If the end was Antiochus IV, then what's up with the past 2,000 plus years of history that took place after the end? What's going on with that phrase? This nice, cut and dry, wrap it in a bow prophecy has that odd conundrum in it. And so you've got to ask the question of, okay, what is the end and when does it begin? What's going on here with that phrase? Does it mean that this prophecy just happens to parallel stuff that happened a few hundred years after Daniel really, really well, but someday in the future, we're going to have this other Medo-Persian dynasty that's going to get taken over by this other Grecian dynasty, and that's going to be broken apart into four pieces, and this little horn's going to come out and terrorize. Is that what that means? Like, it just happens to do really well, but that's not what God meant. There's this other prophecy in the future. I don't think that's not the best way to interpret it. That's a little far-fetched, I think. I doubt that much. Does it mean that this prophecy is going to get fulfilled again in the future? Is that what it means here? Or does it mean that this prophecy maybe started the chain of events that brings about the end, whatever the end is, and maybe we've been living in the end since then? That could be. I actually like that one. Maybe it's a mixture of some of the above answers to this question. Let's try and walk through some of the potential answers. For one, did you know that the Maccabean revolt ushered in the time of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? The Pharisees and the Sadducees, if you know your gospel history, they're the ones who, because of their fighting and have all the situations going on there, they're the ones that eventually were the people who pushed Jesus to go to the cross and caused the people to rally around that cause. They're the ones who were born out of the Maccabean revolts because it was during a day and age when people were giving up their Judaism. They're sacrificing it because they wanted to stay alive, and Antiochus attacked him. So then these Maccabeans started these different groups of, no, I am a Jew, I'm very proud to be a Jew, and not only am I going to follow the Jewish law, I'm going to create laws to make sure that I'm following the Jewish law, and laws to make sure that I'm following those laws about the Jewish laws too. And Jesus had a few things to say about going overboard with rules and laws and things like that, but that's where it started with. It was during that time period there. Not only that, but the great male goat, Alexander the Great, paves the way for the Roman Empire. He doesn't initiate in the Roman Empire, but he's kind of the one who like made smooth the paths for it. And the Roman Empire comes in, and they create the Pax Romana. And if there was ever a time that you were going to save all of humanity by one person's actions, it would have been during the Pax Romana. The Pax Romana is the first time in all of the history of the world, and one of the few times in all the history ever since then, that we've all been united in language and in physical location, too. There was roads actually going in every which way back then. It was never before the Roman time period before that. Also, everyone spoke the same language, at least trade language. They all learned Greek because of Alexander the Great, and the Romans pick up on that. It wasn't until then that everyone would have been able to communicate a couple hundred miles away super easily. And then this gets ushered in. What better time for the Messiah to enter the world than when there's also peace in the land? I said there was never a time, in first service, I said the Pax Romana is the only time there was ever peace for more than like a day or two. I mean, just knowing any history, when is there ever peace in this world? There's always a war going on somewhere. During the Pax Romana, though, the Romans showed up and said, you are not fighting and we're in charge. And it wasn't until the Romans started to lose power that war started up again. And so it was a great time period for a Messiah to come on the earth. I was corrected by one person, though, who came up with one time during the Middle Ages for about 20 years when there were no wars. But okay, so there was one other time period of about 20 years when there were no wars. But that was during the Middle Ages when everyone was dying for other reasons. And so the Pax Romana is probably the better time to have done this. And that groundwork was laid because of what happened during this prophecy's fulfillment here. Furthermore, history repeats itself. I mean, we know that. Even for people who know history, history always seems to repeat itself. The book of Revelation shadows and borrows quite heavily from the book of Daniel. It does that with the book of Ezekiel as well, and some other places in the Old Testament. But if you read Daniel and then you read through Revelation, it feels like deja vu at many points. Because there's all this stuff that seems very similar and seems to be, like, didn't I just read that? And it's, yeah, history kind of repeats itself. Biblical prophecy just relies on older biblical prophecy because it works, because we do a lot of the same silly things quite often over and over again. And so one question then is, well, then can we use this Daniel talking about the end to give us a good walkthrough and a roadmap for the future of what's going to happen on this earth? And I don't know about that with this particular prophecy, because it's kind of had its fulfillment, I think, in Daniel chapter 8. But can we see some shadows in it that are going to get fulfilled in time? Some things that are going to be repeated, some things that will pick up some themes that are going to be recurring. And yeah, I think that's pretty easy to do, actually. It's going to act as some good foreshadowing of the end, I think. And so what foreshadows do we see? What shadows do we see in Daniel chapter 8 and the culture of that day? And what things can we look at to be aware of the end? And that someone's going to rise up and try to throw truth to the ground. A horn's going to go on the offensive against the prince of princes. Antiochus, during those days, he is somebody who, and everyone who followed him, told all of God's people to just shut up. That was what Antiochus did. He said, just give it up, try to fit in, jump on board the Hellenistic train, and ignore everything about your past. Who cares if something's morally reprehensible to you? Just go with it, because this is the direction culture is going, so get on board. That's what happened in Antiochus' day. Also, the pursuit of personal happiness through immediate gratification, regardless of future outcomes, was something that was pushed very heavily in Antiochus' time. Things like, you know, give up all of your past culture and history just so you can get ahead on this very day. Don't worry about tomorrow. Worry about staying alive today was one of the pursuits then. Human reason became the vehicle by which everything was judged during that time period. A lot of the philosophers, the famous ones that we still even read some of their works today, were from that time period. That's when a lot of the things were birthing, is the philosophy and that reason, supernatural reason, is not acceptable. Just go with human experience and current reason and use your mental faculties alone. The Ten Commandments were outlawed. They were cast out of the public square and were not allowed to be in any discussions whatsoever. Truth was attacked. During Antiochus' day, people who practiced their faith were killed in ways that were meant to be ironic as well. And that's the setting of the time period of Daniel's vision. Now, some of those things remind us of some things today, right? Some of those things have some shadows of things today in them. But what if I told you that other times in history, it's been even more like Daniel's day since then? There's been times in history that we look back, and those were even more familiar to what was going on during Antiochus' day. Less shadowy and a lot more accurate in the past in this vision of the end. I'll repeat myself again and say this: history repeats itself. And so, if you study Christian history, there's actually not a single generation of Christians that ever lived that thought they weren't seeing shadows of the end of the world. There's not a single generation of Christians that didn't see signs of the end all around them. And I think that's supposed to be that way, because we're supposed to realize the end did start 2,000 years ago. It is this vision, even though it's all cut and dry and it's done, it ushered in the groundwork for the end. And we've been in the end for 2,000 years. And so we're constantly going to see shadows of these things come up and up and up again, because the end was brought about in the aftermath of the Daniel 8 vision, I think. The aftermath was God coming to earth in Christ. And this prophecy set the stage for the Messiah to come and laid a lot of the groundwork for it. And in the chapters of Daniel, we'll see even more stuff about Jesus coming, and that gets foretold in some of those chapters to come. But if the end means that Christ will come soon, if we keep seeing shadows of the end throughout history, what does that mean for us? It means that we happen to be living in the end times. I don't think the Bible's wrong when it says that we're in the end. For 2,000 years, we've been in the end, I think. Which sounds funny to say that it's been going on for 2,000 years, but we've been in end times for a long time. Now, will it last for more generations? I don't know. I don't know if we're the last generation or not. Will it be done tomorrow? It could be just as easily tomorrow, I think. We're living in the end times. The verse I read at the beginning of service talked about we're in the night now. It's nighttime. We need to keep sober-minded and awake because the night is around us. We don't know when it's going to happen. The thief is going to break in when the thief feels like breaking into the house. But we don't know when the thief's going to break in the house, so keep ourselves awake. It's like Jesus' parabolic prophecy foretold in Matthew chapter 24. Jesus said, "But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." He told that to his followers 2,000 years ago because they were supposed to be ready then too, just like we should be ready now today as well. The end is near. I don't know how near it is because God's God and his definition of near is quite often different than we try and give it that definition. So I don't know. It could be tomorrow. We see shadows of the end all around us, I think. I think we're supposed to be acting like the end is at any time. It could be in the future, distant, I don't know, but it's still near. We're still in the end, and the lesson is still the same, that we're supposed to stay awake because it's nighttime. So be sober-minded and alert. But what do we do in light of this? Okay, we know the biblical phrase, be sober-minded and alert, but what does that actually mean? I think we can do a couple things. One is we realize that we're living in the end times. That's an important thing, I think, for Christians to get a hold of, is realize that we are living in those days. And it's not that I'm seeing the writing on the wall behind every little piece of news we get there, because, I mean, you can do that with 2,000 years of history behind us, actually. It's not that I'm seeing that. The writing's been on the wall since the writing was, like, first on the wall in the book of Daniel. The writing's kind of been on the wall for the world since before that. So I'm not trying to spend all my time figuring out when prophecies are being fulfilled and all this stuff. Just, I know I'm in the end. I don't need any prophecies to tell me that. Jesus ushered in the kingdom of God on earth. And the kingdom of God is not compatible with the kingdom of man. And so the end has been close and getting pushed against itself for a while now, I think. But what we do with that is we treat each day as precious, like we might not have tomorrow because we're in the end. And we treat each interaction we have with someone else as precious because they may not get another chance to hear from someone else about Jesus and that, hey, we live in the end and that God is coming to save the day from the world, but sometimes that means save the day from our own consequences. And so God is coming, and be ready. We also realize that things could get much worse than they are now, and probably will get much worse than they are now. We like to point fingers at rulers we don't like and say that they're fulfilling some prophecy somewhere, and maybe they are, but things have been bad for a while, and things are a lot worse in other time periods even. And the shadows of the past, which could be foreshadows, they've been pretty scary at times, like way scarier than anything we've got going on today. And so don't give up the fight, but don't pretend like the fight just started either. But it's going on, so jump on board as soon as you can. Don't lose hope either when the world gets worse, because God's going to win. God's in charge. God gave spoilers to that history back 2,000 years ago. He's seen the rest of the TV show. He knows how it ends. And he says we're going to be okay. In Daniel, spoilers of Daniel chapter 8, it ended in about 3.5 years. Do you know what the biblical number of 3.5 means? I mean, you've heard it before. If you study Revelation, prophecy, things like that, you've heard the number 3.5. Do you know what the biblical number 3.5 symbolizes? You know what the number 7 symbolizes, right? What? Perfect. It symbolizes complete. It symbolizes enough. It symbolizes wholeness. It means, you know, this is, if I did something 7 times, I did it as many times as I possibly could have. Isaiah, for example, he does 7 things to the garden of God's people, and then says, what else could I have done? There's not only 7 things you can do to a garden, but he meant, I've done 7 things, I've done everything I possibly could have. And so if 7 is the number of complete and wholeness, what's half of that? What? 3.5, yeah. what's half of enough? Not enough. Done. If 7 is going to be complete, half of that is it's going to be over. And when is the time period fulfilled in Daniel chapter 8, which I think foreshadows in some ways history to come, is that when things get bad, it's never going to be 7. It's half that. It's going to be over and done. And that's good news. These things are going to stop. They don't have an end date of infinity, it's they have a period at the end of them. And that's good news there. And so the answer for when does the end begin is, I think it already has. The answer for when does the end end might be the more important question, and that's, I don't know. Don't ask me. But treat it like it could be any minute now. I think that's an important lesson for us. God knows. He knew the yet-to-be history thousands of years ago. I'm sure he knows the yet-to-be history of any future moment today, and he's got it covered because he's the most powerful, and he's never surprised. Those are good things to know about And that applies to our tension of this book of Daniel thing. The end is near because it's already here, but at any moment the spoilers could turn into reality. So we need to make sure we're ready. Are you ready? Are your loved ones ready? Are your neighbors ready? Is that person you happen to see whenever you go to Walmart, are they ready? Not that you affect their salvation and make them ready by any means, but is the reason why they're not ready something that could be on your shoulders? Make sure it's not.